The American public's just not prepared to walk out one day and find out their ATMs aren't working, they can't get any water, their heat's off, their electricity's off, et cetera, and those things could happen. Welcome to Shield of the Republic, a podcast sponsored by the Bulwark and the Miller Center of Public Affairs at the University of Virginia. I'm Eric Edelman, non-resident fellow at the Miller Center, Bulwark contributor. And I'm joined by my partner in all things strategery, Elliot Cohen, Professor Emeritus of Strategy at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies and an Atlantic contributor. Elliot, how are you? I'm in the sunshine, but I gather it's raining where you are.
It absolutely is raining. In fact, you may hear rumbles of thunder from outside. It's steamy, and the string beans in our garden have begun attacking our deck. So we're just trying to eat them down, but it's a struggle, and I'm not sure I'm winning. It's good. I've finally been in the same place for 2 weeks at one time. That's been a bit unusual for me over the last few months. We recently went to see The Odyssey, and all I'm going to say right now is I think the people who've been saying that there's too much violence, too little sex may have a point, but I know we're going to have somebody on who actually reads ancient Greek and has a much more nuanced and sophisticated and thoughtful view. So I won't go too far with that.
Yes, we'll have to keep our viewers and listeners in suspense. But yes, down the road in several weeks, we will have a mystery guest to help us untangle Christopher Nolan's Odyssey.
Yeah.
So I'm going to start with my jackassery, which is the story in the Washington Post that the president over the weekend, when he had his war cabinet meeting in Camp David, losing it with his Secretary of Defense, Pete Hegseth, because of fact that we have munitions shortages. Who knew, that this was a problem? This has been, discussed in the media for months now that this is an issue, but the president apparently only discovered it recently. And as you pointed out to me, Hegseth was very quick to throw his deputy under the bus, even though for most folks who follow things at the Pentagon, he seems to be one of the few points of light over there and also working hard to actually solve some of these munitions problems, which are of long standing.
You know, one question I have about that, I'd be curious to know which one you think it is. Do you think Trump was told about these things and either just didn't pay attention or didn't penetrate or he didn't believe it or something like that? And to what extent do you think this reflects people simply not leveling with him and just saying, oh, no, Mr. President, everything's fine? I mean, there have now been a number of stories which are quite disturbing. And I think you even see them a bit in the Maggie Haberman and Jonathan Swan book, that people just don't want to give him bad news at all. That's a much worse problem than in the first administration. I mean, who knows? Neither you or I could know, but we can speculate since we're podcasters. Which do you think it is?
Well, I think, there's a little bit of both going on. I mean, certainly, I've just finished this Haberman Swan book, which is really quite equal measure, both alarming and, kind of terrifying. So, yes, clearly people are walking around him. He's cosseted and not hearing bad news. But in this particular instance, I think it seems pretty clear that General Kane has all along talked about risk, including munitions. But, the question always is also not what people are telling him, but what he hears. And he does seem to have very selective hearing when it comes to some things that he doesn't want to know or doesn't want to think about. And so, I mean, it's fascinating that he's been denouncing the Post story and saying it's not true. I mean, if you want to talk about protesting too much, there are at least two Truth Social posts that deny this story, despite the fact that the journalists at the Post who've done this, I know two of them and are very capable journalists, but also saying that anyone leaking about the munitions, shortfalls is committing treason, as if our adversaries can't count, as if they can't You know, look at the open source budget documents that tell you, you know, how many missiles of what kind have been purchased, and then count up the number of strikes that CENTCOM claims they've executed in Iran, and do the math. And of course, your colleagues at CSIS have done a masterful job of documenting.
Yeah, they really have.
So,
yeah. So there's nothing surprising. Well, I think we should have more to say about that because I think. I mean, to me, part of the story is Trump really increasingly feeling backed into a corner. But let's talk about that when we talk about Iran. So my jackassery, well, I have two jackasseries. First, you know, at Shield of the Republic, we really, as we look at the world around us, we see a great deal of jackassery, not just in the United States, not just in the Trump administration, although they bear the burden of our wrath. But I noticed an interesting piece of jackassery in Ireland, a country notable for free riding on Western security for many, many years. The executive jet of the prime minister, or as they call him, the Taoiseach, was a Learjet and it was getting long in the tooth. And so they replaced it with a new French jet, a Dassault Falcon. For about $60 million and change or something like that. But then they discovered that it has a navigation system that's made by an Israeli defense firm. I think it was Elbit. And so they insisted that it be removed. And the problem is now that it's not safe to land in the fog. Now, since I'm sure that Ireland is normally a country that has 363 days of sunshine a year, that won't be an issue. Although I've actually been told that it gets kind of foggy there. And so they're kind of caught by their own stupidity, which it seems to me qualifies as jackassery. The other
no more tealings for you.
Yeah, well, I'm afraid that although I like tealing whiskey, I've shifted my allegiances really back to Scotch whiskey and to some extent some very fine rye whiskeys, which you can now get in the United States. The other piece of jackassery is the Trump battleship, you know, which some people, including some of my colleagues at CSIS, think will never sail. So the Congressional Budget Office just came in with an estimate that it's going to cost about $23 billion per ship. Again, let me say that, $23 billion. These things are supposed to be about 2.5 or 3 times the size, the displacement, to be technical, of an Arleigh Burke destroyer. They will have roughly the displacement of something like an Iowa-class, maybe a little bit less than an Iowa-class battleship from World War II. Now, this is at a time when really big surface vessels are pretty clearly going to be increasingly vulnerable to things like hypersonics in a world where, you know, overhead surveillance has just gotten better and better and better. And the assumption that these things won't be big, juicy targets and that you'll have plenty of them is really very hard to believe. This, by the way, the $23 billion figure is, I think, something like about 50% higher than the original estimate. So this is one more act of folly. Unfortunately, like some of the other jackasseries we talk about, there's some potentially quite serious consequences.
Indeed. So we normally don't talk a lot about domestic politics here. Occasionally we, you know, veer into it. But this week seems like evidence of the horseshoe theory just is abounding around us as the extreme right wing of the Republican Party and the extreme left wing of the Democratic Party appear to be meeting in midpoint in their hostility to Israel, in their support for kind of non-interventionist foreign policy writ large. What say you on that?
Well, I you know, we discussed this before the show, and you're right. We don't usually talk about domestic politics all that much, but I do think this is one where it's worth beginning to think through where some of this is going to take us. So the immediate trigger, of course, was the quite narrow victory, but victory nonetheless, of Abdel el-Sayed in the Michigan Senate primary against a sitting congresswoman with a very solid record who outspent him by a considerable margin. And there are a couple of things that I took away from that. First, I mean, he ran on a platform that was rabidly anti-Israel. And when I say rabidly, I mean it. I mean, if you look at some of the advertisements and so forth, they make you, even if you're very critical of Israel, they make you very, very uneasy because they felt to me that they're edging over into, you know, typical Jewish conspiracy theories about Jews. But more deeply, this is another example of where the energy in the Democratic Party is coming from the left. Abdel El-Sayed is not formally part of the DSA, but he's certainly adjacent. He's got people working with him who are very much from that world. He is willing to associate with some very bad people, Hassan Piker being the absolute worst, you know, one of these guys who believes that we deserved what we got on 9/11. The energy in the Democratic Party is clearly there. And although they are putting up more of a fight, I think, the moderates and centrists, they're putting up more of a fight, I think, than the Republicans did over the Tea Party, which was a, you know, a more normal kind of libertarian small government thing. It's not clear to me that they're going to win. It's not clear to me that they've got a real platform. And what this, you know, what these folks can tap is a demographic of, interestingly enough, not minorities so much, not African Americans, not so much Latinos, not so much working class, but white, college educated, middle class, probably downwardly mobile people, or people fearful of being downwardly mobile. I think this drives a lot on both ends of the spectrum. That's not unique to us. I mean, that was in many ways the story of, unfortunately, of a lot of European countries in the 20s and 30s, that fear of downward mobility, and it comes on top of AI and
Europe in the post-war period. I mean, it's the classic sociological right. element for Peugeotism, for instance, in France.
So the foreign policy implications of this, I mean, there's a particular piece of it that's about Israel, which I think is tapping into some very, very disturbing tropes. But quite apart from that, I think what you're seeing here is a consensus between those two ends of the horseshoe, which I would describe as sort of neo-isolationist or isolationist, that is frequently overtly sympathetic either to Russia or to China or to both, that for sure does not see the United States as playing an important role in the world, whether it's through the use of military power or not, which is running, I think, which is getting fuel from an abortive Iran war and previously from the Afghan and Iraq wars in a variety of ways, some of which I think are understandable, other ways which I think is disingenuous. And I think, unfortunately, this is going to be a power to be reckoned with. I mean, it's, you know, not everybody in the United States was an isolationist in the early 30s, but the isolationists were a very, very powerful minority, and they exercised real influence. And it was part of a country looking inward. So I have to tell you, I'm actually now really quite concerned, because I think you have two parties that are pretty dysfunctional. So you could...
You're moving closer to me on the doom scale. So, I mean, I welcome this sudden burst of realism on your part. So, I find it's all equally troubling. And I know that you and I talked. I sent you Garry Kasparov's piece. I mean,
yes,
who wrote a terrific book a decade ago about Putin and warning the West, winter is coming, about what is the threat to democracy was. I mean, the book is enormously prescient. People should go back and read it. And so I thought in particular his piece in Persuasion about the dangers to the Democratic Party of the DSA takeover. And it goes back and says many of the things, you and I discussed last week about this, that also I talked about with Mona on her show 2 weeks ago, that, you know, this DSA is very different from the organization that originally was founded by Michael Harrington. And I commend Gary's piece to people. I mean, he points out, look, the, you know, Republicans let themselves get eaten alive by MAGA, and look where, you know, where that led us. And so his piece is really a call for Democrats to wake up and stand up for their party and push back against this trend. Now, having said that, I mean, I'm an equal opportunity abuser, and I think it's fair that, you know, this week, that same week that we have this primary election, we also have Tucker Carlson convening a really witch's Sabbath of people at his home in Maine, including Marjorie Taylor Greene, Joe Kent, a couple of other folks, to basically Thomas Massie, to lay the groundwork for his manifesto that was released yesterday that calls for a third party. And they apparently were encouraging him to run for president, which is, I think, a very, you know, real prospect. And if you look at the manifesto, I mean, not only does it kind of recycle a lot of, you know, anti-Semitic tropes about Jews controlling the, you know, the country, the country's fallen under the sway of a, I mean, he doesn't quite go to, you know, Zionist occupation government, but he's, you know, pretty close. It's really the more polite version of that, I would say. But again, you know, pro-Russia, you know, anti-intervention, you know, it's very, very worrisome. Now, in one sense, and tell me if this is completely crazy to think, in one sense, maybe this is not a bad thing, in the sense that if it draws out of the Republican Party a lot of these anti-Semitic people and nuts and conspiracy theorists, it maybe makes it more possible to envisage a post, you know, Trump Republican Party that maybe begins to get healthier. I don't know. I mean, it's that may be a vain hope, but it's just very striking that you this week you see these two, you know, allegedly, you know, opposite political forces meeting in the middle.
Yeah, there was a piece by Rod Dreher in the Free Press, and Rod Dreher, for those who don't know him, I think he was Catholic. I think he's now Orthodox.
Yes,
he was sort of a paleo conservative, but really going after Tucker Carlson on anti-Semitism, saying, "Yeah, the guy really is an anti-Semite." And I think Rod Dreher cares about this because he knows that this is, you know, it's a disease that certain kinds of extreme conservatives are susceptible to. On the particular Tucker Carlson things, I have a number of thoughts. One is, to some extent, this just feels like Pat Buchanan round two or three. That, you know, these are elements of the party that have always been there. Secondly, you know, you said a witch's Sabbath, you know, could also be the Isle of Lost Boys. You know, the people you mentioned are all kind of wackos and misfits, who are not, and this is where they're different from DSA, who I don't think can organize a party. I mean, maybe Tucker Carlson, I think, might be willing to run for president if he just had to give a few speeches. Would he really be willing to do the incredibly hard work that it takes to be plausible? I'm not so sure. I tend to agree with your theory that it might draw some of the poison, but I think this may also be an indication of something else, which I've been thinking for a long time would happen, which is there is a world after Trump. I mean, Trump will be out of the presidency. He's old. He could get very sick or even pass away. And so people are beginning to angle for what happens next. Now, the problem is he's leaving something of a shell of a party, but it is striking that you're beginning to see the signs of, I wouldn't call it a backbone, but of some willingness to take him on or to disagree with him or not simply go along, you know, at least in the Senate and a few other places. So I worry about that. There's another dimension to it, which you would also raise with me, which I want to get to, which is what the next generation looks like. With the Democrats, what I found very disturbing is there was a piece in Axios It was Jim Vandehei and somebody else, about sort of what are the six stages that a party goes through when you confront a Trumpian moment. And he says, this is happening to the Democrats. And I forget all the stages, but first you say, no, we can't have anything to deal with them. And, you know, at the end of the day, you're like the Speaker of the House, you know, just doing whatever the guy wants and on bended knee. And you're already beginning to see some of that with the Democrats, where, you know, the same people who thought Abdul al-Sayyid, this guy's, you can't get along with him. Well, they're going to endorse him and support him. So, you know, the problem is, I think you now have two fairly unhealthy parties. The Democrats a little bit healthier than the Republicans, but I think the signs are ominous, and it could be, you know, as you know, I'm a long-term optimist about the United States of America, but I think this unfortunately reinforces my view that getting out of the Trump era will not be a matter of one election, but it could be a decade or even more before we disentangle ourselves. Could you, you showed me a very interesting and again disturbing piece in Politico by Kathy Gilsonen, who used to be at The Atlantic, who I worked with, I have high regard for her. Could you describe what's in that? Maybe we should talk about that a little bit.
It's the counterpoint to my earlier, you know, uncharacteristic eruption of optimism, about the Tucker Carlson third party drawing the poison out of the Republicans. It focuses on the kind of young staffers, think tank world, Congress, et cetera. And it's not just Kathy who's noted this phenomenon. Others have written about it as well, including Rod Dreher, by the way, that a distressing number of young people gravitating to the, you know, right side of the aisle in Congress are, as she put it in the title of the article, you know, a generation of gripers. It's, you know, people who, you know, listen to Nick Fuentes and are kind of Nazi adjacent, you know, think the Holocaust wasn't a big deal, you know, et cetera.
If it happened.
And so it's a very worrisome, you know, sign for the future. And because these are the people who, you know, some of them will run for office, others will have influence on legislation and the long-term direction of the party. And I just, you know, found it extremely worrisome and disturbing.
She quoted, it's a very good article, all these things I hope we'll put in the show notes. She quoted, I think, a staff director in one of the committees in either the Senate or the House saying, on top of all that, you know, not only are these people kind of fanatical, they're really ignorant and they don't know how to, you know, they don't know history, they don't know foreign countries. And I think the reference she made, and I may botch it, but this is the gist of it. He said, you know, I think this was somebody who may have been at Heritage. If I'm hiring somebody, I'd hire somebody like to work in the Middle East who maybe had spent a year or two living there, maybe knew Arabic, had views which aligned with our views about what we ought to be doing in the Middle East. And I really couldn't care less about where they stood on abortion. And he said, now what you get is people for whom that or something else is a litmus test, but who also just don't have the expertise, don't have linguistic expertise. You know, you and I can talk about this at great length. Frequently now don't know how to write and just hand it all over to AI, which can turn out a finished looking memo, but it means you haven't gone through the work of thinking things through, don't have a network of contacts in some of these countries. So it was very disturbing. I think the only solace I would offer as I think about it is, it's only relatively recently that we've had the idea that government has to be staffed by people drawn from think tanks or congressional staffs. You know, that was not the case, say, in World War II. And I suspect that what might happen is presidents, who, if assuming we get sane ones, let's say if it was maybe Rubio or a successor to Rubio or somebody like that, they may just say, okay, we're going to have to look elsewhere. We'll look to business, for example. We'll look outside outside, you know, the normal place. We'll look to city and state governments where you have to have people who can at least do things. And it's, and it would be a different model, you know. But look, it was the model that built the New Deal and that got us through World War II. And there was no, you know, you didn't have people turning to staffers and think tanks.
Yeah, I mean, if the Democrats, for instance, were to end up with, you know, one of their governors, I know Gretchen Whitmer said she's not going to run, but somebody like Whitmer or Shapiro or Pritzker, someone who has actually been a successful executive and therefore might be able to, you know, run and staff a government.
Let me add just one other thing. Let's say in the best scenario, you know, the Dems sort of hold the line. And let's say you get a moderate centrist Democratic presidential candidate and they're running against J.D. Vance, who I think don't think is a particularly good politician, and they win. So Gretchen Whitmer or Josh Shapiro or Andy Beshear, somebody like that. The problem is going to be that they will have to do something or feel they have to do something to buy off that wing of the party, because that's where the energy is. And here the problem, I think, is much worse than it was with the Tea Party. Tea Party didn't, I don't think, particularly had foreign policy views. And the Tea Party was relatively small. But these folks do have foreign policy views. And I think they are bigger, actually. I think they, and they have more energy. And so willy-nilly, they will be compromising with them. They'll be putting in some of their people into government positions where they will not feel loyalty to the president. They will feel loyalty to, you know, whatever their ideas are. That could be quite worrisome.
Yeah.
Third Love makes bras that actually fit, so they know this. If your bra feels uncomfortable, the problem isn't your body, it's your bra. Third Love designs for comfort first. Soft fabrics, support that doesn't dig, pinch, or slip. Bras that feel good and look good under everything you wear. Shop Third Love and explore over 60 sizes, including AA through H, and half cup sizes you won't find anywhere else. Get $15 off your first purchase at thirdlove.com with code PODCAST15.
Well, with apologies to our audience, because I'm sure they're sick and tired of us talking, you know, nonstop about Iran and Russia and Ukraine. I mean, we do have two large wars going on, and if you're going to be talking about national security, you can't avoid discussing these. I want to talk about Iran because we got a couple of different things going on there that I think are important. But one is, per our conversation last week, you know, the president was threatening once again to exact an enormous price, and then over the weekend called it all off. So where do you think we are? And you raised the point last week about would Iran be willing to take yes for an answer? I mean, we're still going through that in some sense because you've got this ongoing negotiation between Iran and Oman about opening the strait, in which the Iranians seem really bound and determined to kind of squeeze every drop of, you know, benefit they can out of the leverage they have from holding the strait right now. You know, they don't seem to understand that there are other ways to look at the world besides instant gratification. I mean, they could get a deal that, you know, would go, you know, carry them for 60 days, and by then the president might well have lost interest and moved on to Cuba. But they're continuing, I think, to make it a little hard for him to swallow what they're doing. And some of that, it seems to me, is a result of the collective leadership we have in Iran, not because I think that they're, you know, moderates and extremists, you know, but more that there's a collective leadership and everybody gets a veto, and everybody is sort of maneuvering to, you know, put themselves into the best position to lead down the road. And as a result, it's harder for them to get to a consensus.
Yeah, what I would say is I think it's a fractured leadership. There's a good piece in the Institute of Study of War said there are basically three factions. There's the ultras who don't want to ever do any deal with the Americans ever.
The Pedari faction, yeah.
There is another faction which is just really hardline and really wants to humiliate the United States, is not willing to yield an inch on terms. And then there's a group that's realizes that they've got a incredibly good deal. The MOU wants to run with that and has some concern about the economy. I think for Trump, on the one hand, there's no question in my mind that he would like to be done with this. and move on. And there are a lot of people telling him he really needs to. However, I think that the howevers remain, that I suspect they've internalized that there's a good chance that they'll lose the House. He's probably feeling better about the Senate, given what's happened in Maine and Michigan, because, you know, the chances are better for Susan Collins and Mike Rogers. But in any case, I think he knows very well. The House may vote to impeach, but the Senate won't convict. He is, I think, tremendously focused on legacy, as we've discussed many times. I think one of the key things for Trump is to be seen as a winner and not a loser. And, you know, he is somebody who's been living in fantasy land, or at least has been able to construct reality around his version of it. And what's happening is he is increasingly running into circumstances where that no longer works. You know, you were teasing me about coming closer to the doom end of the spectrum. And one of the things I always used to tell my kids, between your desires and wishes and reality, reality always wins. And I don't think Trump actually fully grasped that. But I think in this case, he understands that the reality is this is the war that he will be known for. You know, most presidents are known for a war. He knows that this is going to go down badly because he's, in that respect, I don't think he's stupid. And so it just makes it very, very hard for him to really compromise. I think the things you're dealing, both sides are in some ways have distorted views of reality. Both sides have, you know, fantastic egos. Both sides desire to humiliate the other. Both sides are possessed by rage. So in that case, even if there's a logical outcome, and I think this, we may have discussed this a little bit last week, even if there's a logical outcome, which would be, in that case, an American defeat, let's be very clear. I think anything that compromises in any way on the Strait of Hormuz, that's an American defeat. That's an American loss.
And it's hard to see any kind of outcome that doesn't end there right now.
Well, I mean, unless you're willing to just kind of have either a sustained... Well, I can see other outcomes. I mean, I can see a sustained quasi-blockade with, you know, all kinds of repercussions for the economy. I could see a major pulse of violence, particularly if the Iranians take another shot at the Israelis will not be restrained about right. punching back.
Of course. But that's one reason why the Iranians have, you know,
right.
avoided that.
But you know, look.
They're not completely irrational. They certainly have.
Nobody is ever completely irrational. But people make really bad decisions,
of course,
yeah. all the time, and I as you've heard me say before, I do think one of the problems with the commentary on this war is it's so relentlessly solipsistic. It's all about us. Well, the truth is it's about us, and it's about the Iranians. There was another dimension to this, by the way, which I wanted to talk to you about. So we had that bizarre episode where there's an attack on the Minnesotan water systems, cyber attack, pretty clearly identified as Iranian. And Trump, President Trump, makes this crazy thing, saying, well, it's all Tim Walz's fault. And, you know, well, it turns out I think there's at least six other states that were hit. And you know what? Nobody's talking about that. Nobody's saying, wait a second, the United States is under attack. This is really important. And it's a very sad statement about where we are, that you can't have both Republicans and Democrats saying, whoa, hold on a second. This is a direct attack against us. And thank God, you know, nobody really died from this. But these things could get a lot worse. I mean, there are a lot of cybersecurity experts who have been thinking about it. Not a peep. In the same way, I will also say, it's striking to me that the Iranians did try to kill Trump. We know that from the Biden Justice Department.
And that has weighed very heavily with him. That's big theme in the Haberman-Swan book.
And of course, and it should. But now, you know, you've had all kinds of public threats, not just by kind of marginal people in Iran, but by government officials saying, yeah, we're going to kill him. We're going to kill Melania. We're going to go after his kids. We'll go after his grandchildren. You know, you have parades of people say, we will kill Trump. Even Republicans aren't saying, whoa, whoa, whoa, that's not okay. You know, we can't live with a world where you can threaten to kill the president or members of his immediate family. So this is another thing that makes me very uneasy, because I think this ties into our previous discussion. It's unfortunately a symptom of a profound lack of seriousness about the hard side of international politics.
So cyber attack on the water system, you know, at one level, kind of this strikes me as one of Trump's superpowers, right? Which is he can say something crazy like, oh, it's Tim Walz, and boom, the thing becomes a non-issue. Look, there's a broader issue. Put aside Iran. I mean, we know from open testimony by former FBI Director Wray that the Chinese are sitting inside our critical infrastructure, have been for years. And if we ever got into, God forbid, a conflict with China, you know, there would be some serious disruption to American domestic society. This is something we tried to flag for the public in our 2024 NDS Commission report, that the American public is just not prepared to walk out one day and find out their ATMs aren't working, they can't get any water, their heat's off, their electricity's off, et cetera. And those things could happen. So to me, this is a symptom of a much, you know, put aside Iran, this is a symptom of a much larger kind of ostrich-like mentality about something that is clearly potentially in the cards in the future that we're just not looking at, because it's not just Iranian cyber operations. We all know about the Russian operations during the 2016 and 2020 elections. China was, you know, in on the act as well. Now we've got, you know, these threats against critical infrastructure. And this is just, you know, going back to what we talked about last week, the interconnectedness of these conflicts, you know, the fact that you do have, you know, the Ukrainians hitting a Iranian ship in the Caspian loaded with weapons for Russia. This week we got news that a North Korean missile battalion's headed to Russia to take part in a war against Ukraine and to provide missiles so the Russians, who are depleting their own stock of ballistic missiles, can continue to rain down, you know, death and destruction on Ukrainian civilians. So all of these things are, you know, increasingly interconnected. You've got the cyber things, and yet there seems to be this, you know, real refusal to look away. I mean, just today, the press has stories about the Germans in Leipzig discovering they've already had instances of Russians trying to put explosive packages in buildings and on cargo aircraft. German police now discovered a drone, which they are attributing to Russia, that had explosives on it, flying near the Leipzig airport. This is part of a ongoing hybrid war that Russia has been waging in Europe for 2 years, and yet we barely discuss this in the United States.
Yeah, I would add just another thing, which is purely technical, which is the shortage of certain kinds of munitions. So the Ukrainians, I don't know whether it was the first time, but they were not able to shoot down any ballistic missiles coming in to hit Kyiv because they don't have any interceptors. And that's, you know, that clearly has a lot to do with the Iran war. I mean, it says a number of things. It does say something again about the fecklessness, not just I think of our planning for this war, but in general of our defense planning. I mean, I think there really needs to be some major accountability for the fact that, you know, we haven't thought seriously about war. Because if you thought really seriously about what a war might look like, you'd realize, oh, we're not going to need these things by the hundreds or thousands. We're going to need them by the tens of thousands. That's one thing. Your point about people insisting on treating these separately, that of course, is a symptom. That's a problem, I think, in general, in the world of strategy. We'll be talking about my new book, The Strategist, which will be out in October. But one of the things I talk about is, it seems to be to me that the first question you should be asking in any case where you're thinking about the use of force is what else is going on? Because everything is connected to everything else, particularly in our world. But that's been true for centuries, actually. People find that very hard to do. You know, people will somehow assume that what happens in Iran is one thing, Ukraine is another, China is another, when in fact there are all kinds of bits and pieces of connectivity. I think there's a third thing which troubles me to say, but I'm going to say it. And one of the consequences, particularly of the shortage of munitions and stuff, is that the Russians now have pretty much... They can hit with ballistic missiles most of the things they want to hit in Ukraine. What they particularly want to hit is civilians. The logic of this is taking, and the Iranians are doing similar things. The logic of this takes us to where war was from the beginning to be already in the Civil War, the Franco-Prussian War, but certainly World War I, World War II. Societies become targets because the only way that you can win is to break societal will, which matters even in totalitarian countries. And that just makes war so much more destructive and violent. But unfortunately, though, I think that's what the logic of it takes us. Since we are talking about Russia, Ukraine, as well as Iran, one thing I wanted to throw out, I had a conversation with a very senior, very thoughtful, retired European general officer. And we were talking about Europe. And he echoed what I think I've heard now from a number of Europeans, including in their intelligence communities and senior military people, saying they really do think the Russians will try something. And now what his point was, well, it's not going to be tank armies rolling westward, but it'll probably be something like grabbing Estonia, a piece of Estonia, and trying to create circumstances in which the alliance doesn't really respond and therefore falls apart. There's some problems with that. And, as I pointed out to him, things could, you might think you're going to start that way and you don't end up that way, but I think that is something to take very seriously, unfortunately. I don't know what is your view. I mean, I'll tell you the truth. I've been torn between thinking that, yes, that is something that Putin might very well do, and thinking, after that army has taken the beating that it's taken, I find it very hard to imagine they could pull anything off. But what's your take?
I guess what I would say is I don't think it's prudent to assume that they can't do something, particularly if you're talking about the Baltics, right, where unlike Ukraine, which is massive and a 1,000-mile front, they have the benefit of short distance, very small societies, not 44 million, and interior lines of communication and the potential to maybe actually accomplish the fait accompli on a smaller scale, but with very large ramifications than what they did in Ukraine. So I think from a prudential point of view, and it's a number of allied intelligence services, the Danes, the Dutch, several others, Estonians, who believe that within 5 years they are going to do something. And certainly these hybrid activities like the drone in Leipzig that I talked about show that the Putin regime is certainly pushing the envelope, and there's no shortage of voices in Russia, calling for war against Europe, and people who used to be responsible, commentators on the Russian side, Dmitry Trenin and Sergei Karaganov.
I was about to say Karaganov.
He wants to have a nuclear war in Europe.
Yeah, I think people always viewed him as a little bit hardline, but he wasn't viewed as crazy. And Trenin absolutely was not viewed as crazy. There too, I mean, in a way, it's a little bit like what I was trying to say about Iran, which is we are so fixated on our own undeniable illusions, errors, fantasies. We tend to forget other people are prone to delusions and fantasies. Those can be just as dangerous or even more so.
So let me just make one final point, and then maybe we could turn to our final subject for today, just for variety's sake, so we could go back to Turkey. This seems to me to be a very poor time, given what you and I just discussed, for the Trump administration to be engaging in a forced posture review in Europe that seems to have a predetermined outcome, which is that the U.S. is going to have less force in Europe and is going to be relying on its extended nuclear deterrent, which I think misunderstands the connection between conventional and nuclear deterrence. And raises the risks that we will find ourselves facing a very, very, very, very, ugly situation.
I agree with that.
Final subject, Turkey. I mean, a couple of weeks ago, we discussed Turkey, and I wrote in the pages of the Bulwark that the one word you would not hear was anything about human rights at the summit at NATO, because the president wasn't going to raise it, despite the fact that Tayyip Erdogan has been waging a unrelenting war on the opposition and on Turkish democracy and deepening the authoritarian nature of Turkish politics. Well, that's continuing. I mean, there's a bill in the Turkish parliament now that's meant to codify the ceasefire that was called with the PKK, and this is clearly being done as part of a corrupt political deal to get the Kurds to support changing the constitution so he can run for president, which he's currently barred from doing. At the same time, the leader of the opposition party, after the courts ruled that his leadership of the opposition party was accomplished illegally at a party convention Congress a couple of years ago, has led the formation of a new party, which now is the largest opposition party in Turkey. It also, in polling, defeats Erdogan's party at the polls. Erdogan's now moving to strip him of his parliamentary immunity, and he's being accused of bribery, just like Ekrem İmamoğlu, the mayor of Istanbul, who's been removed and who was Erdogan's leading a potential opponent in a presidential election. Has been charged with all sorts of, ridiculous crimes, treason, and bribery, et cetera. So Turkish democracy being pretty much demolished, and still nary a peep, not only from the administration, but, I've yet to hear anyone in Congress raise their voice and say, this is really a bad thing and we need to do something about it.
Or anyone in Europe. I mean, I think that's also true. The question that I have is, I've been told that on the whole, the Turkish elections remain relatively clean. I don't know if that's still true. And I have also been told, and all these things are things you would know much better than I, that the Turkish population's commitment to democracy is still, and to democratic rule, is still there. And of course, one keeps on hearing that Erdogan is sick. Maybe he's not so sick, but again, like all dictators, he's mortal. So those are potential mitigating factors. How do you weigh those up?
So I can't speak to the state of his health, but he's you know, he's younger than I am. So yeah, he's still got a few years in him, you know, if he stays healthy. I certainly agree that the Turkish public is, believes in democracy and wants to Turkey to remain a democracy. But they have limited choices. They've had limited choices because they've had Erdogan and then they've had some very feckless opposition for a very long time. And as to the freeness and fairness of elections, I mean, people used to say all the time that Turkish elections were free but not fair in the sense that the government had overweening ability to influence the media, which is ubiquitous in Turkey, a lot of newspapers, a lot of television stations. And because a lot of their advertising came from government-owned entities, the government had a huge amount of influence. Well, now it's very much the case because Erdogan essentially controls all the media in Turkey for all intents and purposes. So, it's not even... It's not possible at this point to have a fair election. Free election, they're less free than they used to be. I mean, there's more fiddling at the ballot box than used to be the case. And a lot of that has gone on in southeastern Turkey, which is predominantly Kurdish area. And I suspect it's one reason why he's trying to cut this deal with the Kurdish political parties in the hopes of being able to make sure no matter what the outcome, what the real vote is, that the outcome of the next election is that he remains as president. So
it's pretty dismal, not just for the sake of Turkey, which is an important country, but some of the implications for the wider Middle East, for North Africa, for the Persian Gulf, because the Turks are very much all over there. I mean, I think.
And for Europe and NATO also.
I mean, it is. I think we have time for just one more topic I'd like to raise with you. There's one piece of news, which was this swarming of illegal immigrants from Morocco into Ceuta, about 70,000. And there were a couple of things I thought were interesting about it. The Spanish. Spain has been very unusual, and this is the Sanchez government, in saying, oh, yeah, no, we want lots of immigrants. And this really is, I think, one of those cases where the government wants lots of immigrants because they know they'll vote for them. I mean, Sanchez is quite an anti-American populist of a sort. He's also rabidly anti-Israeli, not coincidentally, I think. But there was clearly a major reaction in Spain against this.
They didn't want this.
They didn't want this. I mean, these are Ceutas, this has been Spanish territory for centuries. And I think it's part of the larger story of Europe wrestling with the immigration problem. Here again, I think, I'm struck by you have a huge problem. You had it in the United States to a lesser degree, actually, than some of the European countries, and people just find it really hard to talk about it openly or to take kind of positions in the middle. Say, on the one hand, immigration at a certain levels is a good thing, particularly in countries with low birth rates, which unfortunately now includes the United States. On the other hand, sovereignty means you should be able to control your own borders and make those decisions. That's not a position people find easy to take. And instead, you get really wild extremes of either kind of rabidly and frequently disgustingly anti-immigrant sentiment, or people who just don't seem to believe in enforcing the laws.
Right. That's a huge problem. The European reaction, the second reaction was better than the first. The first reaction was pretty, I think, hypocritical and in some ways contradictory. But, I think this is also not just a European immigration problem. I mean, this is also Morocco being very unhappy that there are these two Spanish exclaves in, North Africa on, contiguous to Morocco, and they would like the Spanish gone.
Yeah.
You know, and
well, look, I mean, immigration can, or emigration, if perhaps is a better way of putting it, can be a weapon. I mean, the
sure.
The Russians weaponized it periodically against the Finns.
And the Poles.
And the Poles. Both countries, which now are quite tough and have really right. sort of fortified their borders. But I think a lot of the Western European countries don't quite know how to deal with it. And the problem is it is unsurprisingly fueling the rise of right-wing parties in all kinds of places, Sweden being an example, yep. France being an example, even Britain. I mean, there are people considerably further to the right than Farage. Listen, I think we're wrapping up. We may want to remind our viewers that in a few weeks, there's going to be a change at Shield of the Republic. You want to describe that for everybody?
Yes, we will by the end of this month be going independent. We're very grateful to our friends here at the Bulwark and the Miller Center who've supported us for 5 years and given us a great platform. I think it's a good time for us to move on and do some additional things that we're looking forward to doing for our viewers and listeners. You'll be able to find us at shieldoftherepublic.com. That'll take you to the Substack, or you can find us at shieldpod at Instagram and Twitter.